It's Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation and right across Australia on the Community Radio Network. My name's Marilyn Hetrelies. This week we're fortunate enough to have a special guest in the studio, Lina Atala. Lina is the founder and editor-in-chief of independent Egyptian news outlet, Madamassa. She spent her career working to keep press freedom alive in Egypt. Madamassa was formed just before the military coup of 2013, and its staff have risked their lives to continue reporting amid growing censorship in Egypt. I spoke to Lina about the challenges she's faced, her hopes for the future of journalism in the Middle East, and about how Madamassa is keeping her going. As a journalist working in Egypt, you were previously the editor of major English language newspaper The Egypt Independent before it was shut down. Can you tell us about that experience?
So Egypt Independent was the English edition of a major establishment publishing different media outputs in Egypt. And in early 2013, the management of the newspaper cited a sudden financial crisis on the back of which they decided to shut down the operation and send off all the crew working on it, which I was managing basically. So it was a group of about 25 journalists. But also after the whole ordeal happened, they mentioned the political differences between our crew and the overall newspaper. And they also cited concerns with our stances against the military institution, which is not something that the broader corporation was preferring at the moment.
A UNESCO study found as many as 186 laws that restrict freedom of press and expression in Egypt. How do you deal with press freedom limitations in the Middle East? Is self-censorship and media bias still rife?
So, there are many ways in which media freedoms are repressed in Egypt and the region, and the laws are only actually a form of it. The 180-something laws that you refer to is just one form of it. In fact, censorship in a place like Egypt is in many ways manifested in informal channels and through, forms of intimidations that are unspoken, that are extra legal in many ways. So it's not only the laws that restrict media freedoms in a place like Egypt. Self-censorship is certainly a form or a way through which a lot of journalists and media outlets negotiate these restrictions. But we're also very conscious and aware of the extent to which self-censorship, sneaks itself into our practice, and we try to resist that as much as possible. So we are very alert to it, because also self-censorship can become extremely embedded in your, inner psyche. It doesn't have to be a political position. We're self-censoring today. It can be, there's so much fear that, it's subtly in there, and it sort of permeates your decision-making processes. And yet we're trying to be in the new organizations we've set up together after the previous one was shut down, so the current one is Madamassa. We are very conscious of resisting that inner sensibility towards self-censorship. So we never, for example, refrain from choosing to cover a certain story because we know it would get us into trouble. We never refrain from trying to speak to a certain source that is considered contentious or controversial by the authorities because we are fearful. We never definitely reject publishing a story after it's done because we think that it would get us into trouble. We just try to raise as much as possible our bar in order to, be able to continue, because we also are concerned that the moment we start self-censoring, it will actually continue to, again, sneak itself more easily into our practice. So there is this active resistance, very conscious resistance to it amongst us.
And do you have any specific examples of how you've gotten around this?
So, for example, in October of last year, one of our investigative journalists wanted to do a story about a potential small coup within the military institution that eventually proved to be not so much of a coup, but more of a court case prosecuting a number of officers within the army. It's a very contentious thing. It's in Egypt, it's a big taboo to write or say anything about the military institution without its prior consent. In fact, this is one of the 180-something laws that you cannot write anything about the military without its prior consent. And he proposed the story, and we knew from day one that, you know, if we go ahead with a story like this, even with the very small likelihood of him being able to report it and to get the needed information about it, if it comes out, it's going to be a big problem for us. But we decided to sort of tame the fear that we were all feeling collectively, including the reporter himself included. And he eventually managed to write the story, and we eventually managed to publish it. We didn't quite get around because he eventually got summoned by the military prosecution and was about to face a big trial because of the story, and the newspaper was also about to face the consequences of this step. But then there was also a major international campaign demanding his freedom because he was in custody, and this kind of put an end to the whole ordeal. It kind of put some pressure on the authorities to basically release him and put an end to the case. So, but that's an example of a story that could have completely not come to the light because of the self-censorship, and I'm certainly very happy that we did not go down that path.
So you spoke of informal methods of intimidation that the government uses on journalists. Could you describe some of these?
So one of the ways in which journalists are typically intimidated in Egypt is that, for example, if there's a protest and journalists go out there to cover it, there'll be a heavy police presence and there'll be on-site targeting of journalists, physical targeting of journalists in a way that, you know, is making today most journalists think twice before going out there and deciding to cover something from the ground. And this has been a real challenge because we've been proponent of, you know, being on the field, doing things from the ground as opposed to doing them from the desk. But we've seen that the price for that is becoming heftier and heftier, especially if the very life of the journalist is in question. So targeting during physical protests is one form of it. Gag orders are typically issued on contentious issues that the government doesn't want to see coverage on. So, you know, if you break the gag order, you start facing certain intimidations. So those are forms of it. In big organizations, in big mainstream organizations that are privately owned, there is typically a relationship between the security apparatus and the chief editors and the publisher. So instead of actually shutting down the newspaper or directly imprisoning journalists, there'll be like calls between the security apparatus and the chief editors to basically, ask them to shy away from writing about a certain story or ask them to pay attention to this particular reporter because their reporting is seen as contentious. So there is this dynamic of informality that is also that takes place side by side to the more like formal and official means of the laws and the courts and the prosecutions and so on.
And do you know any journalists who are now behind bars?
I know a photojournalist whose case has been mentioned quite a lot. His name is Shauken. He's a photojournalist. He's been in prison since 2013 on charges of causing public disorder through his, photojournalism work. You know, we know many others. It's just unfortunate that the case of journalists in jail in Egypt has gotten less and less attention after the release of Peter Grest in Australia. And I think one of the things that happened with Peter's in incarceration is that it brought a lot of attention to the case in Egypt. But also, unfortunately, when the case was almost resolved, the story of journalists behind bar in Egypt is getting less and less traction in the world.
Your independent digital outlet formed in 2013 before the military coup. You say it was born out of crisis and inevitability. Where does the name come from?
So Madamassu is the Arabic word for the horizon of Egypt. And that's because it was set up in 2013, right after we were fired, and at a moment when it was very hard for a group of independent journalists to find anywhere else to work in Egypt, because it was a time when a lot of the, or if not most of the media outlets in Egypt were deciding to align themselves with the upcoming authorities, and it was certainly not an environment in which we could work easily. So we had to establish our own organization in order to be able to continue being journalists, or else we would have had to depart from the profession altogether. So when we say that Madamassu was the offspring of inevitability and of crisis, it's because we certainly had to create it in order to be able to work, or else there was no other possibility. And we called it a horizon because we were thirsty for being able to, you know, look ahead and be able to, you know, to make sense out of the chaos that has become of Egypt today. So it was also, in a way, a statement of defiance and hope at a time when, you know, nobody wanted us to look ahead. Everybody wanted us to, like, sit back and you know, look down and be disengaged, basically.
And Madamassu has been going for 3 years. Do you feel like it's achieving what you wanted to achieve?
I'm very happy that it has survived a tumultuous 3 years in the political life of Egypt. So, I mean, its existence today is in and of itself an achievement. But I also have a lot of ambitions for it, in the sense that I don't want Madamassu to only be hinging on the crisis, on the political crisis of Egypt. I want it to survive and to become a media of reference that is there to survive and to sustain itself on the longer run. And that I have question marks around. There are a lot of economic challenges. There are, of course, the ongoing political challenges. If we survived those last 3 years, I don't know for how long more we would be surviving. So of course, I have concerns and question marks around, you know, how far we can go with the bigger ambition that this media outlet has become, especially with its interest to produce, you know, a new form of journalism that is engaged, that is progressive, that is very experimental, that does a lot of unlearning of you know, the very traditional and conventional media practices that are out there in Egypt and in the world today. So all of these things, we are yet to achieve them, but we also, I don't know if we'll be given the time and the possibility to be able to achieve them.
And how have you been able to experiment with different ways of storytelling, which was one of your aims?
So one of the things we've been talking about in the newsroom and with our colleagues is that, of course, because we are online and we are in this interactive space that is the internet, it is important to venture into, you know, different forms of multimedia, audio production, video production, and so on. But also at the same time, we always thought that when media trends are so much oriented towards these new forms, there is some power in text and in writing and in long form journalism that tends to be kind of sidelined and thought to be less important, especially online, especially when you say that most of your readership is young. And, you know, in Egypt, over 60% of the population are young people.
That's right. I'm surprised to hear that.
Yes, we are mostly a population of young people. But yet we thought that we should be brave enough to invest in different forms of writing, in long form, in text, in strong editing, in, you know, encouraging different voices to venture into creative writing, into even like putting some creative writing in the more rigid form, journalistic form. So that's one way, one form of experimentation we've been very invested in and I've been very happy about, I'd say.
And just with the funding issues, how have you managed to keep Madamassu funded over the past 3 years?
So we have a lot of contractual agreements with media development organizations in the world that are interested in, you know, innovative media practice in the world and in the region in particular, on one hand. But also we've been very invested in trying to build a sustainability model around the knowledge economy that is the media. So we have a diverse media model that, you know, is based on organizing events, organizing concerts, also doing editorial services and translations for other clients. So it's a very hybrid model that also includes advertisement, but also that doesn't depend on one economic model in order to ensure that, you know, different streams of revenue are coming into the organization.
Is that the sort of model that you see for the future of journalism?
I mean, we certainly don't have answers because we're not sustainable yet and we've got some years to go. But it's also a model that we're betting on, and we're betting on continuing to experiment with it in order for its fruits to start being reaped. So I think we need a bit of time, but we're doing quite a bet on it, I'd say.
Madame Masser is collectively owned by 23 founding journalists. How does this sort of collaboration work in practice?
So basically, in terms of the inside workflow, it's a traditional management model. But also when it comes to the strategic development of the organization in terms of, you know, what kind of growth prospects we have, what kind of organizational structure we want to have or to tweak. Those are the kinds of decisions that we'd have to take collectively as co-founding members. So it's really a question of engaging the journalists in strategic decision-making processes of the broader organization because they are co-owners, while on the day-to-day level, it's more of a traditional management structure.
You've witnessed three different leaders, dictator Hosni Mubarak, Muslim Brotherhood Mohamed Morsi, and the current military strongman al-Sisi. How did the reporting situation differ between them?
So, I mean, it hasn't been so different, to be honest, in the sense that it never felt like a completely free environment. The only moment where we felt a certain laxity was just after the deposition of Mubarak, when there was an interim military rule until President Mohamed Morsi was elected. But other than that, we always felt scrutinized, and, you know, we always worked and operated with the sentiment that, you know, we are going to be on the tip of being shut down or closed or imprisoned or whatever. So yeah, journalism has always been a dissident act under the different administrations in Egypt. And, you know, the case continues to be the case today. And it hasn't necessarily changed with this gesture of election that is considered a marker of democracy. So, you know, maybe it's easy to expect this lack of freedom during the time of Mubarak, when there weren't even anything close to free and fair elections. But even with the election of Morsi and later the election of Sisi, we are still living in a situation where we feel extremely restricted. In fact, sometimes in ways that were never the case before, even during Mubarak's time. So it's quite paradoxical.
You go out of your way to make sure you can cover the stories that need to be told. What's the biggest challenge you've had to face? Have you had to risk your life, risk your freedom?
I think fear is the biggest challenge, the fear of what could happen, right? The fear of losing freedom. I mean, we're not so much talking about the fear of losing life right now, because we are barely doing any field reporting, because there is barely any political action in the streets of Egypt today anyways. It was the case up until 2013, when we were out there covering the protests, covering forced evictions of and dispersal of protests and encampments. 2013 in particular was a year of perils for us as journalists, and for particularly those of us who were doing street reporting. It's less the case now because, as I said, we're not doing much street reporting. But the fear now is to really lose your freedom and to end up in jail, which is not necessarily a price any one of us wants to pay, even though we defend so much practice of free journalism and so on. So I'd say fear is the main challenge. yeah, fear is the main challenge.
And how do you deal with the personal toll of your journalistic ventures?
That's a hard question. maybe by also playing out the exciting parts of it. So, you know, it's easy to victimize and to say it's such a hard labor and it's full of perils and it's full of risks and so on. But it's also very exciting to be, you know, working with copy, you know, intellectually engaging with fellow journalists on, you know, angling and sources and positioning and ways of writing. So it's also, there is a creative part of it that we try to play out. And also, I mean, we also try to play out the fun aspect of it. You know, again, like I said, one of the things we do in Madame also as part of our economic model is organize concerts and events and, you know, bring back laughter to the table and, you know, not to be overtly dramatic about it. And I think this also pays off for our personal lives because we feel like it is a nice social experiment and it's not just, you know, a state of exception that we are working with.
And you grew up in quite a conservative family in Egypt. How do you think that shaped you as a journalist?
My family is not that conservative. I don't know where you got that
I've
from.
Read that your family is conservative comparatively. Maybe they're not. What kind of upbringing did you have and how did that shape your career as a journalist?
Yeah, I came from an average Egyptian family. They have some conservative stances on certain issues, but they are also extremely supportive. I think also through the practice of journalism I've been engaging with and through my community and my colleagues, they saw the promise of good and progressive journalism. So they have become, on their own right, defenders of free journalism and independent journalism and good journalism. They've been calling for it. They've been also expecting it from other media outlets. They've been more media literate thanks to the kind of journalism that we've been producing. So they've been very supportive, and I think that's been very helpful.
Madame Asra reporting has been picked up by media outlets around the world. For example, the coverage of the Third Square protests against military rule and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Could you tell us a bit about those stories?
One of the things that made Meta special at the beginning in 2013 is that we came out at a highly polarized moment in Egypt's political history where, you know, a big part of the population was just, you know, blindly supportive of the military institution when another portion was just blindly supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, we were coming out to say, well, you know, how about this very basic act of witnessing that is the responsibility, act of witnessing and recounting that is the basic responsibility of the media. So we came out as completely autonomous and independent players out there, showing that, you know, the truth in Egypt cannot be reduced to just those two to this binary of the military versus the Muslim Brotherhood, and that, you know, life is much more complex, and it's not just a binary, it's a spectrum basically. And we started reporting about manifestations of the spectrum, people in the middle who are not supportive of this group or that group, people who, you know, seek the truth, for example, people who have this critical distance. And I think that was an interesting position, and that's why it was captured in other by fellow media and by international media, because there was this interest of seeing this completely different image that was completely masked by the other media due to their alignments.
Is investigative journalism for you extremely crucial at this point in time in the Middle East?
I think it's one of the most important forms of journalism that needs investment and further work and further engagement from our side, and which this is what we are doing. I think it's, you know, also in terms of civic engagement, I do not necessarily think it's a time for advocacy work in Egypt I do think it's a time when there is a dire need for information to reshape the narratives that are out there, and it's the field of investigative journalism to do that, basically.
And what obstacles do you face in accessing information as a journalist in Egypt?
Well, of course, we don't have any guarantees for information, for freedom of information flows in the country. For example, we've been struggling to pass a law that, you know, give us the right to access government and state information in general. And there has been a lot of resistance from the authorities to let this law pass, for example. So access to information, particularly government and state information, is a major challenge. But also, thanks to state propaganda, there has been a rising skepticism across the board from different players, you know, even, you know, private players, businesses, and so on, from the media. Everyone is very skeptical to, you know, pass on information to a journalist. There is less of a belief in the mission of media and journalism in, you know, in telling the truth, and then and accordingly less collaboration. So it's harder and harder to get information.
And what do you see as the media's role in holding the powerful to account and representing minorities?
It's exactly that. It's basically, you know, representing diverse voices, voices that do not get, you know, featured by other media, and, you know, basically embarrassing, very easily embarrassing and openly embarrassing the authorities with, you know, their flawed practices that do not get exposed elsewhere.
What is your proudest moment where your journalistic work has really made a change or an impact?
It is hard to pinpoint a moment where the work we've done has directly translated into actual change, besides really this big and euphoric 2011 moment that we all share the pride in. It's not, you know, solely the field of or the category of journalists that can claim this moment. Everyone can claim this moment, but I also claim it very well as a journalist, because I do think that the independent journalistic movement prior to 2011 is one of the catalysts that, you know, supported the uprising, in 2011. And whether we like it or not, even though we are in a very difficult political moment, 2011 was still a marking moment in sort of unsettling this historic relationship of the people to the authorities, to the state. So that's definitely one proud moment out there. But then, you know, my other moments of pride are really not directly connected to the change we are able to make. It's maybe a much lower bar. It's related to being able to survive, of not withdrawing. It's been very easy to withdraw in Egypt, to politically withdraw in Egypt today, and to just be depressed and to stay in our houses and look down and feel there's nothing to be done. So the fact that we are operating up until now, and what I call constantly manufacturing hope at a time when it's very hard to find it anywhere else, I think is a constant moment of pride. So it's we're less, we're less ambitious when it comes to when it comes to pride. It's smaller moments of victory that, that, you know, give us some pride. And I guess we're happy about that because it keeps us going.
And do you have any journalistic idols in Egypt or the Arab world?
I think my hero right now is one of our very own investigative journalism journalists. His name is Hossein Bahget. His name might have come out in international media because of his brief incarceration, because of the military coup story that he published and which we talked about. But also the many other young people who whose names are lesser known and whose work is, you know, managing still to you know, sort of advance cutting edge narratives at a time when you don't find these in Egypt today.
And as you said, 60% of the population are young people in Egypt. You do work with young people in at Madamassa. What's it like? What are your strategies for bringing in young people?
It's not so hard because I'm not so old myself. So we, I guess we understand ourselves well. And I think it's the key thing is to establish an organizational culture that is a little different from the one that exists in mainstream media organizations, which tend to be like small microcosms of the dictatorship of the bigger dictatorship that is Egypt, and that Egypt has been for years and years. So I think the key thing to working with young journalists is to cultivate a progressive organizational culture where everyone is a stakeholder, where everyone is a co-owner, where everyone is consulted on big decisions, on taking risks, where, you know, power is not accumulated and concentrated in the person of the chief editor or of the publisher and so on. I think this plays out something very important. And another thing would be a sensibility towards what the youth want to read and trying to constantly offer that.
And looking to the future, how do you see yourself pushing boundaries of mainstream media in Egypt in the future?
I think I see this happening through my initiative and a lot of other small initiatives, you know, either operating online or on a smaller scale, but also sort of multiplying and managing to say, to show the complexity of the situation in Egypt and showing so many alternative images out there in such a way where that, you know, very solid, rigid, mainstream, unified image will completely be unsettled with time and will be completely unsustainable due to this, you know, diversity and plurality of images that are sent from various sources. So I see on the longer run the hope as, you know, stemming from a lot of small pockets of dissent out there.
You're able to report on these issues in the Middle East from the ground. How important is it to have relationships with international media organizations? Do you share resources?
So we think it is important. Our priority, of course, is to build our constituency locally. And in order to do that, you cannot really do too many things at a time. But that said, we do think that it is important to stay on the radar of international media. In fact, with less and less international media presence in Egypt, which story doesn't matter that much internationally, the presence of local players like us becomes an important site of mediation and awareness for a lot of these international media to stay tuned to the Egypt story and to keep covering it at least sometimes through our lens. So we do have some formal agreements. For example, we have a formal relation with The Guardian through their Africa network, whereby they basically republish some stories that they find poignant from our coverage, and that, you know, provides a continuous sort of eye on things happening inside Egypt. There are similar, you know, sharing content agreements with other international players. And there is an international interest in the kind of work we do precisely because there aren't too many channels of awareness into what's happening in Egypt today. It's been hard. The environment has been highly restrictive. And yet, we've always managed to operate from a certain site of marginality that I always call a site of alternative arrangement and, in fact, empowerment in many ways. And that site still exists. In fact, this is how Madamassu exists. You know, we are nothing but, you know, margins to Egypt's mainstream today. And, you know, with the presence of amplifying mediums and channels such as the internet, you can be on the margins, but your messages and your voices can, you know, sneak into the mainstream at different points in time. Not always, not consistently, certainly not constantly, but we're also not in a bubble, definitely. We are in the margins, we manage, but it's also an extremely and increasingly porous environment, and we make use of that.
Well, that's it from us on Fourth Estate. Thanks to my guest this week, Lena Atala, from Egyptian publication Madamassa. Lena was brought to Australia by the Walkley Foundation for their annual Storyology Festival. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Fourth Estate podcast. My name's Marilyn Heterlees. You can catch us at the same time next week.